From WHQR Public Radio in Wilmington, North Carolina, this is Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis Hilburn. Men are taking on more responsibility in the household today than they did a generation ago. But according to the Pew Research Center, women are still doing the majority of the domestic work. That's true across the spectrum, including couples in which both people work full-time outside the home. So what does this mean for a career professional who is female? While moving up the ladder, women struggle with what sociologists call the double bind. It's a pervasive cultural attitude, often unconscious, that requires women to be nice and friendly, but also tough and decisive at work. If a working woman decides to have children, University of Massachusetts sociologist Michelle Buttig says she's making the worst possible move for her career. To help us understand why and what other implicit biases affect a woman's pay, career prospects, and self-image, we have Associate Professor of Sociology at the University of North Carolina at Wilmington, Jean Ann Sutherland, with us today. Jean Ann Sutherland, welcome to Coastline.
Thank you, Rachel.
We're also very glad to have with us today the co-founder and CEO of Cape Fear Women in Tech, Emily Ann Aurelius. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
And we're inviting you to join the conversation. Are you a working woman or a working mother who grapples with barriers in your career? Are you married to a woman who's pursuing a profession outside the home? Call us during the live discussion on this Wednesday at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org and tell us about it. Jean Ann Sutherland of UNCW, what is the difference between a strong, successful woman and an ambitious, aggressive bitch?
Well, certainly that depends on the perspective of the person judging said woman. In the workplace, of course, women are in kind of a double bind, whereby if they demonstrate classically masculine characteristics, such as an aggressive personality, and so forth, they are cast as the bitch. We've seen that with women such as Hillary Clinton. We've seen it with, I used to hear about it a lot when I was young, with Barbara Streisand and the way she directed films as being a controlling bitch and so forth. But you never heard that about Francis Ford Coppola or others who were equally demanding and controlling and so forth. And the other connotation, of course, really has to do with someone mistreating someone and so forth. So, and going back to the workplace, if a woman exhibits too much femininity, she's in a leadership position, she's not really taken seriously. And that's the bind she's in.
And what does that mean, exhibiting femininity or masculinity?
Well, it's I'll give you an example. I have my students, at the beginning of a gender class, I'll have them throw out adjectives of what does it mean to be a man and what does it mean to be a woman? And semester after semester, the same words come up. So for what does it mean to be a man is aggressive, decision maker, provider, protector, muscular, it goes into physical kinds of things. Whereas for women, it's things like nurturing, passive.
The word passive
will come up and the word aggressive will come up every semester.
And you're talking about current students. That's some of that sounds like it might have come from a sociology class of students from the 1960s or 50s.
Well, what I'm asking them to do is throw out not necessarily how they feel about it, but how I'll say if someone came from another planet and you had to describe to them what the culture defines as man and woman, what would those words be? So as we go on in the course, of course, they demonstrate that the problems with a woman walking around with a passive personality in terms of trying to succeed in the workplace and so forth. So they're a little bit more critical of it, but these are the words they throw out. And so once we get that list, I'll say which set of traits will prepare you most for a successful job in leadership. And of course, the traits fall under what does it mean to be a man? So going back to my original point that if women deviate too much from that list, what does it mean to be a woman? Then they're viewed in a derogatory way. In the same way, another topic, but when men deviate from that list, they're called derogatory things too, right?
That's right. Emily Ann Aurelius, CEO of Cape Fear Women in Tech. What is Cape Fear Women in Tech, and why did you feel the need to create this in the first place?
So Cape Fear Women in Tech has an interesting origin story. It was actually Wilma's leadership initiative was thinking about it one day, and they reached out to Tech Mountain, and they said, how would you feel about jointly creating a women's group for women in technology? And at that time, Audrey Spiker, who's the co-founder of Cape Fear Women in Tech, was the head of Tech Mountain, and she was like, yeah, we really need to do that. The story that always goes that Audrey and I, whenever I'd be at a tech conference around town or even in Raleigh or something like that, we'd look around the room and I'd see like this sea of guys and one unicorn, and it'd always be Audrey. So I'd say, "Hi, Audrey," and she'd wave back. So she reached out to me after this conversation transpired, and she's like, "How would you like to lead this group with me?" And I said, "That would be amazing." So she has the soft skills, like the connections, the people skills, and I always had said that I had the hard skills, which at the time I was the senior database administrator for Castle Branch. So I did, I know how to do all the back end, front end, technical type stuff. So that's how it started. We both realized, everybody at the same time, there's nothing more powerful than an idea whose time has come. And everybody realized that this was something that needed to happen. So it did.
And tell us why. What kind of experiences do women in technical fields have that really require some kind of networking / support group?
Mm-hmm. One of the biggest things is that IT as a whole, as a personality type, we tend to be very introverted. So it's hard for us to meet other people. And when you're a woman in tech, you're in the extreme minority. So you might be the only one in a technical class or the only one in the IT department who's a female. So that you definitely notice it after a while. And you're like, oh gosh, I'm the only one. They're all looking to me like I have to uphold this idea of what the ideal woman in tech is. And that's a lot of pressure for an individual to be under. So this is a support group for us. So we do things like networking. We have panels, speakers, and workshops. So we focus on hard and soft skills. Hard skills being this is how you program a website. Soft skills being this is how you ask for a raise, because we believe both of those things are necessary for professional development.
And that's interesting. You talk about skill building, very practical skill building, but you're also talking about how to ask for a raise, which implies, I don't know, Jean Ann Sutherland, less confidence than a man might have in a similar position?
Absolutely less confidence and lower expectations, which is a real problem for women in the workforce. The numbers are pretty depressing in terms of how many women hold executive or professional positions. And we find that roughly 60% of men say there are plenty of women in leadership. And surprisingly, almost half of women say it.
Our perceptions are off in terms of parity here.
Right, yeah. So one of the explanations is the idea that women don't have those high expectations. And that's one reason that there's a lot of push to have more women in executive positions, because when women are modeled, when younger women have that model, of course that can shift then.
Mm-hmm. So many elements of that to unpack, but can we talk about this confidence gap for a moment and just the whole idea in the specific scenario of asking for a raise? Why do men tend to have more confidence in that situation than a woman? How does a woman come to be an adult and just possess less sense of her worth?
Well, certainly a great deal of that, of course, is socialization in the way that we start talking to little girls and the expectations we have for little girls, starting with the toys we give them, et cetera, throughout their childhood.
You give us an example of that, like a scenario with a little girl and a toy that would kind of maybe take a whack at her sense of what's possible for her?
Well, certainly, this has been a focus lately, the idea of very gendered toys. And so when you walk down the girl aisle, of course, you see these pink colors and so forth, and you see things like dolls, which, you know, we can say teach a girl how to nurture, you know, teach a girl how to mother, kitchen sets, things that are geared toward the home, things that are, dare I say, passive. And for the boy toys, you certainly see more action-oriented, more take charge, and so forth. Video games you see marketed more to boys. Even things like Nerf guns. I heard a woman recently say that she got her daughter a Nerf gun for her birthday, and she said, you know, they make them for girls now. And I thought that
what
was really...
What does that mean?
I don't
know. Are they pink?
They're pink.
Are they pink? I guess. They blow out powder puff balls. I don't know. But I thought that was really interesting. So, parents, even young parents, are still adhering to that. So, dare I say, the word entitlement, I know that people really don't like that word, but men possess it.
And when we come back, I want to talk a little bit more just about this idea of women being primary caretakers and what that comes from. You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 FM, talking about working women, working mothers, and how gender roles have changed, how implicit biases affect a woman's work life, and maybe what she can do to blast through the existing barriers. With us today, the CEO of Cape Fear Women in Tech and a UNCW Associate Professor of Sociology. You can call us during this live Wednesday discussion at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. We're learning today about some of the gender biases that still afflict women in the workplace, what challenges working mothers face that fathers often do not, and how some local stakeholders are trying to change stereotypes and the opportunities for women. Jean Ann Sutherland is an associate professor in the Department of Sociology and Criminology at UNCW. Emily Ann Aurelius is the co-founder and CEO of Cape Fear Women in Tech, part networking, part support group to foster professional development of women. And they're taking your questions on this Wednesday. You can either call us today at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. Professor Sutherland, we've seen evidence that working women today are doing less housework than their mothers. Men are generally doing more housework than their fathers. And then when you were talking with our producer earlier, you said a lot of women say to you, oh, but my husband is great. He helps. Mm-hmm. And that made me laugh out loud. Can you just talk about what that illustrates about this continuing cultural norm?
Well, it definitely speaks to perceptions of fairness. And there's a lot of studies that fall under that, perceptions of fairness. Like, in other words, why are women not more furious about this? And so when the partner, husband, is doing more than she witnessed her father do or his father do, there's such a sense of gratitude. And of course, in our culture, we expect the mother specifically, and even single women in relationships, to have sort of the control of the household, to have the management of the household, if you will. And so, the woman is typically the one who is judged for the presentation of house, the presentation of children, etc.
Is that why women seem to care more? Because, you know, there have been some couple struggles when a woman has said, fine, if you don't care about changing the sheets, we won't change the sheets.
Mm-hmm.
And then the sheets will literally stay on the bed for two
right.
months, the same sheets. Emily and Aurelius, you're grimacing. But is that... Why is that, typically women seem to care more about cleanliness in
mm-hmm.
the house?
Mm-hmm. Well, again, like I said, I think it has to do with how they're judged versus how a man in the household is judged. And, you know, going back to that help thing, it's really fascinating because you hear it a lot, not just with housework, but with childcare. You know, the sense that any kind of participation is so appreciated. And it's interesting because a lot of the literature talks about how couples, when they get together, will talk about, let's do what we're best at. That's how we'll divide up the chores. If it's not completely 50-50, we'll get close, but let's do what we're best at. And then in my focus groups with mothers, they'll talk about how bad he is at loading the dishwasher. So he says, well, why don't you just do it? Because I'm not good at that.
convenient.
Emily Ann Aurelius, do you see in your Women in Tech group, are there discussions like this about how needing to do the majority of the domestic chores impacts a woman's work life? Is there any kind of discernible impact there?
I would say definitely. When you, and this is something that we talk about more on a one-on-one basis in the group than we have. We haven't brought in a speaker on this exact topic yet, but there's just so much mental and emotional work that goes into running the household and making sure the sheets are changed and the dishwasher is loaded and the kids are driven to, you know, soccer, football, whatever it is they're doing, and then the child care. And so all these different jobs, all these different hats that women have to wear and that they're just expected to wear, like chauffeur, laundry service, housemaid, child care. Like when you break it all out, there's so many different roles. And then also it's a full-time job in and of itself. But then when you work on top of that, it's no wonder that we're really struggling to get ahead because there's just so much on our plate that if you can make it, you're like a Wonder Woman. Like I have so much admiration for you because I understand what you're going through. And so it's really important that your partner understands and supports you and that you have these conversations and you take care of yourself. Like you look at your energy levels and you're like, where can I offload some of this and what do I need to do to take care of myself?
And while we're on this very specific topic of the division of household chores, is there a way, and this is for either of you, that you can have a conversation with your partner that is non-threatening and non-accusatory and might result in some ways that, as you say, Emily Ann, you can offload some of the onus?
Mm-hmm. I think just bringing it up, the doctor was saying earlier, she was mentioning that just talking about divvying up the chores and making sure that whoever's best at what gets they help with that. But also, I don't know, you have to realize it yourself. Like you have to take inventory of all the things that you do. And you're like, wow, I actually do a lot. It's that cultural norm and that idea that we're supposed to do all of that kind of blinds us from the reality of how much we are accomplishing in one day. And so to really manage our energy levels and then once you realize it yourself, then you can bring it up to your partner and see ways to truly make it a partnership as opposed to a one-woman show.
Mm-hmm. Jean Ann Sutherland.
Mm-hmm. It's a difficult conversation to have, which is interesting because what we tend to find is that people have this conversation when they get together, for the most part. When the relationship is new. And when we really see the change is the birth of a child. Mm-hmm. So the workload increases significantly for both of them. But it increases, I've heard estimates of about 50% more for the mothers than the fathers. Then this disconnect happens. And like you said earlier, men are doing more. Women are doing less, but there's still a tremendous gap. And so to have that conversation, I don't even know how I would advise a couple to have that, because it is very tricky, because it can be very sensitive. It can, you know, a person can feel very insulted and have the argument of like, well, I do the garage and the yard work, and that's really labor intensive. And she says, yes, but I have to cook every day. You only have to do the yard once a week or so.
And that is such a good specific example of mm-hmm. a typical conversation, I think, that a lot of people have probably mm-hmm. had. Mm-hmm. So how do you get around that? I mean, because you would like to think that in a committed relationship, there's this feeling of teamwork. Like, mm-hmm. this is our house. This is our life. We share everything. So I don't care if he does a little more or I do a little less, or I do a little more on this day and he does less. It's we both want to contribute to the household. How do you get past that sense of, well, I did this, so now you have to do that? That feels small-minded. It feels selfish somehow.
I would suggest therapy.
You have to have an outside mediator to divvy out your chores.
Definitely. Oh. And not a mother or mother-in-law.
Yes. That's true.
In the city of Wilmington, according to statistics from 2012, there were nearly 14,000 male-owned businesses, about 8,000 female-owned firms. That's about 63% male versus 36% female. New Hanover County had a similar percentage. In Brunswick County, 32% of businesses are female-owned of the total. Are there differences in the difficulty for women when it comes to owning their own business versus climbing a corporate ladder? Certainly, there's the division of labor, but when you're an entrepreneur, you're also able to make a lot more of the decisions on your own. Emily Ann Aurelius, do you see women entrepreneurs versus women employees who have different levels of challenges?
Mm-hmm. It depends on like the level of the corporation that you're at. And then also, so there's a couple different categories that I would address. One is if you are at the lower level of an organization, then you have the luxury of being able to punch in and then punch out. And it's really nice. You have your 9 to 5, and then you're off, and you don't have to worry about it. When you are in the C-suite, it becomes much more involved, and you have to be able, you have this constant train of thoughts in your head all the time about the direction of the company and how you're going to get around various obstacles, how you're going to sell the rest of the C-suite on a particular direction. So that's something that they're always thinking about. And then when you're an entrepreneur, you are never off the clock. You are always fielding phone calls that, depending on like which teams you're working at, they could be all over the world. So various points of the night, and you just have to be always on and always there to help direct your company. And it's a constant investment. So it's very, very challenging.
You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 FM. We're talking about some of the barriers that women still face in pursuing careers outside the home, some of the cultural norms and implicit biases that contribute to those barriers. We have Jean Ann Sutherland, professor, associate professor in the Department of Sociology and Criminology at UNCW, with us today, and Emily Ann Aurelius, co-founder and CEO of Cape Fear Women in Tech, and they're answering your questions during this live Wednesday discussion. You can call us at 910-343-1138 or email us today at coastline@whqr.org. Lois from Ocean Isle, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Oh, thank you so much. I have just retired from a 40-year IT career.
Congratulations.
Yay. I have worked as a consultant for Northrop Grumman in the Washington, D.C. area. I was an independent contractor. I owned my own business. What else? I've done a lot of things. And so I can answer a lot of questions that you ladies have. But I want to talk about what you were just talking about, to do with the perception about tasks and who should do the tasks and how do you distribute the tasks. And I want to say that there's a hidden tool that people aren't using, and it's called level of effort. And as a project manager, every time I had to manage a program, and I had like 3,000 to-do things on one program I was managing, what you had to do was ask people, how much time is it going to take you to do that? So a lot of time the perception is, if I take mow the lawn and you take do the laundry, it can take you 2 hours to do the laundry, but I can hire the kid across the street to do the lawn, and we're equal.
Right.
Because we both took a task.
So you're saying people should analyze the level of effort involved in each task before divvying up the tasks, and that
yes,
would help
ma'am.
Them quantify how the division of labor in a much more effective way.
Absolutely. And how you can do this is, you know, you can start by getting rid of the honey-do list, because that's what I call an aggravation list, because, you know, men's priorities are often not what women's priorities are and what to do first. But when my husband said, can I help, let me make a list, and I said, no, let's see. Whenever you want to give me an hour, we'll talk about what's the best use of that hour. So on Saturday morning, we say, okay, it took a long time, by the way, to get this through. Let's do 2 hours worth of stuff. And that can include loading the dishwasher. It can include, you know, putting stuff in the laundry. It can include making the bed. It can include, you know, blowing off the leaves on the front porch. It can include
and
a lot of things.
So, Lois, you, though, are the driver of the agenda for that hour or two. Is that right? You're the one.
Yes.
You're the one who's setting the agenda and the priorities, which means you're still managing the household, right?
I am, and that's not because my husband could manage it, but I can get I'm a lot more efficient. So it's a personality thing. And trust me, I am really, he's been in training now for 20 years. you know, the first time that he said to me, because he likes a very clean house, but he doesn't know how to clean. And one day we were first together, and he said we were going to have company. And he looked in the bedroom, and he said, we need to clean this house up before the people come. And I looked on the floor, it was all his clothes, and I said, give me the phone number of your ex-wife. I'll have her come over here and clean this up.
Okay, Lois, thank you so much for that call. Made some really interesting points. And Jean Ann Sutherland, sociologist at UNCW, what do you kind of take away from Lois's conclusions about you taking this time and setting the agenda for it?
Well, if I could start with a little side note that I should have brought up a minute ago, which is that we're talking about all this as if it applies to everyone. And really, we're talking about a very white middle class model.
Yeah.
And in my research and sociological research, we find that these things vary across racial groups, ethnic groups, sexuality, social class, etc. So it just seemed important to note that.
That we are talking about a privileged socioeconomic class here.
And very heterosexual.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
So we find variations. And I just, as the nerd sociologist, I wanted to point that out.
That's an important distinction.
Yes.
Go ahead.
Oh, but it was interesting going back to what Lois said, because I remember being in a focus group or conducting a focus group once. And this was a stay-at-home mom who had a master's degree, and I found that a lot of educated women who decided to stay home really framed it within, I'm not a bad feminist, I'm doing this for these reasons and so forth. And one of the women said, okay, so when my husband goes into work, he's the MOD, the manager on duty, and I tell him when he comes home, I'm the mom on duty. And in that sense of really embracing her role as sort of the manager of the household. I find that really interesting. And so Lois made me reflect on that in terms of her sort of management style in the home.
It is interesting. She also talked about having this high-powered career,
mm-hmm,
working
mm-hmm.
as a consultant. And so it sounds like she navigated those traditional barriers, was able to have the successful professional career outside the home and still manage that. So she had two careers.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Emily Ann Aurelius, you look like you're ready to comment.
Well,
when you hear that kind of anecdote, that kind of description of someone's life, how does that land on you?
I think each arrangement is very specific for each couple, and so that was what worked for them. For me, it wouldn't work so well just because, whenever, I think she phrased it, whenever he wanted to give me an hour. And for me, I'm like, well, the bed's going to be messy every day. The dishes have to be done every day. There's things that just have to be done every day, whereas, like, if he's going to, out of the, gracious benevolence, gift me an hour, I'm just like, I need someone to be in the trenches with me.
We have an email. Anonymous writes, until my mid-40s, I didn't know how to negotiate a raise. I have a PhD and have worked in, this is from a woman, mm-hmm. worked in very technical fields full of women, programming, biostatistics, medical writing. Asking for a raise was frightening. And since we usually don't know how much money others in the same position are making, it's difficult to know how much to ask for. All of my mentors were men. And I never had a conversation regarding asking for a raise. Emily Ann Aurelius, what do you tell women? We're going to go to break in just a second, but get us started about how to do this.
For some reason, it's really hard for women to talk about money, and I've noticed that, and that's one of the things that we're trying to address in our group in Keep Your Women in Tech, is that you have to be able to quantify your value to the company in dollars and cents. Because if you can't demonstrate your bottom line, then they're not going to see how valuable you are.
And I want to ask you more about that, because Anonymous uses the word frightening, and I've seen that before. Mm-hmm. You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 FM. It's a look at women in the workforce. We're exploring how much things have changed since the mid-20th century and what cultural norms haven't really budged. Cape Fear Women in Tech CEO and a UNCW sociologist are taking your questions. You can call us during the live Wednesday discussion at 910-343-1138. You can also email us today at coastline@whqr.org. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn for Coastline. Listening to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis Hilburn. Today, we're exploring how cultural norms and gender stereotypes impact a working woman's and a working mother's experience. With us to answer your questions, Jean Ann Sutherland, Associate Professor of Sociology at UNCW, and the co-founder and CEO of Cape Fear Women in Tech, Emily Ann Aurelius, created to advance women in technology locally by creating a community that fosters professional development. And we want to hear from you today. Do you feel as though gender stereotypes have affected your own career trajectory? In what way? Do you have a harder time liking the idea of a woman executive? Why or why not? Call us during this live Wednesday edition at 910-343-1138. Or email us at coastline@whqr.org. Emily Ann Aurelius of Cape Fear Women in Tech, just before we went to break, you were talking about how your group is actually working to teach women how to ask for a raise. And we had an email from Anonymous who said she had such a difficult time doing that. She learned so many of the hard skills, but didn't learn how to ask for a raise, and she found it frightening.
Mm-hmm.
Why is it harder for women to articulate their worth or make a case for their worth in dollars and cents than it is for men?
I think that, well, in her specific case, she was saying she's not sure how much other people are making around her. And it goes back to that whole dichotomy of, like, females being gentle and supportive and nurturing versus males being assertive and going out there and getting what they want. And for women, one thing that this is gender agnostic, one thing that you have to research is what your role actually goes for. So there are great websites like Glassdoor, Indeed, where you can just look up your job description and find out your market value. You have to assess, like, what is the going rate for my skill set. And then once you know the going rate for your skill set, that's one factor of it. The other factor would be to look at your individual contributions. So did you bring in, did you land like a great partnership, and how did that contribute to the bottom line? How much profit was brought in from that? Did you automate something? If you automate something, then you're saving on labor for the company. So I think it's difficult for us to quantify our value in that way because we don't want to quantify our value in that way. We don't want to say, like, I'm worth X amount of money per year, because we just want to be not quantified. We want to be just supportive and helpful and not out for ourselves. But in business, you have to stand up for yourself, because no one else is going to stand up for you.
And this seems to be evidence of the confidence gap, which is actually the name of a book written by two internationally known journalists, Katty Kay of the BBC and Claire Shipman of ABC News. And in this book, the authors detail how differently men and women perceive themselves and their prospects. They cite research that shows that men will often apply for a job if they meet maybe 60% of the requirements listed for that job. And if a woman has 99% of the requirements, mm-hmm. she'll fret over that possibly missing 1% and maybe not go for it. Emily Ann Aurelius, how do you counsel women who have that kind of self-doubt?
Whenever somebody creates a job description, it's more of like a wish list. And you have to find out what is the most valuable trait that the person or this hiring actually wants. Because good managers, they hire for how you are if you are teachable, if you can be a good fit for the culture, if you are willing to learn, that's more important than your skill set. Because skills can be taught, but your personality and your ability to fit in, your ability to contribute, that speaks to your character. So,
I want to get to this email from Anonymous. This person writes, as women's opportunities expand, there are often two professionals pursuing careers in a family. How does Wilmington fare for the trailing spouse, the other spouse, when one spouse comes here for a job? And how is that evolving from primarily being the woman to today, when it could be the husband or the wife? Mm-hmm. Is this something that you've seen, Jean Ann Sutherland?
It's certainly something I see in academia, because typically one person is hired and the other follows. And if it's an academic couple, and they both have their PhDs, of course, it means that one has a secure tenure-track job, and the other will typically land an adjunct position, which is more work in terms of more teaching hours and significantly less pay. And so there's a hit to that career. And it's mostly women.
Mostly women who take
say,
the career
I
hit.
Would say it is. I don't know the actual statistics at UNCW, but that's observation. And so, watching people I knew in graduate school and so forth, it's very tricky. And, of course, there are those that, move around from university to university, and that means that their partner will uproot their occupation again and again, which can be problematic. Yes.
We had a caller earlier. I want to mention this. Dan from Wilmington called in and said, my wife and I share the responsibilities 50-50. I don't necessarily support how all husbands are lumped into one category. It hurts men who are responsible and who help in the household.
Oh, absolutely. I should have said that whenever a sociologist opens her mouth, she says, for the most part.
Right. And you're talking about the trends.
Trends,
What the research shows. Dan is a minority.
Absolutely. And we applaud him. And, so in my gender class, I start the semester by pointing at all the men in the class and say, we're not talking about you and you and you and your dad and your uncle. We're talking about trends. We're talking about norms of masculinity and so forth. So, but I understand that when we talk about any kind of social trend, the person who's not experiencing it can really feel sort of aggravated by those results.
Mm-hmm. Adele from Wilmington called in. She says, I was a proud working woman, but when my child came along, it changed everything. I'm interested in Professor Sutherland's work on women and guilt.
Oh, yes.
I think my employer understands my being a working mother and understands some of the guilt that I have. Also, Wilma has great sources mm-hmm. about asking for a raise. So, mm-hmm. So talk about the guilt that today, in 2018, working women
absolutely
harbor.
There's still a tremendous amount of guilt expressed by middle-class moms in particular. I don't hear it when I talk to low-income, mostly African-American moms. When I do a focus group with middle-class moms, within 7 minutes, the word guilt, it comes up. As opposed to low-income moms, when I have to bring it up at the end and say, what do you feel guilty about? And for middle-class moms, a lot of it has to do with work, because it has to do with not spending quality time, because some of the, you know, the norms of mothering means I'm always caring for my child. I'm always with my child. I'm teaching my child. I'm bathing my child, you know. And when work gets in the way, they can speak of guilt. But interestingly, usually how they get around that, middle-class moms, is they say they're a better mother by working. So they're presenting a better example to their children, both boys and girls. So, you know, it's kind of that cognitive dissonance thing where
now,
it's like, yes, but I'm a better mom by doing this. So that kind of offsets some of the guilt, you know.
There are people I know that will argue there's a case to be made for the mother being the primary caretaker.
Mm-hmm.
A child needs his or her mom. Moms are so important. And without mom as the primary caretaker, the child is missing something in his or her development. Is that true?
Well, that's certainly the dominant thought, but there's a lot of research on fathers, and in fact there's a book that I read once called Do Men Mother, and it's thinking of the word mother as you know, a verb. So, you know, do they carry out mothering in that sense? And we find that yes. I mean, you know, in sociology we're a little critical about all this being genetic in our genes. These are skills. So a woman who births a child doesn't have some sort of genetic advantage to change a diaper. It's learned in the same way that the father learns it. You know, this notion of intensive mothering definitely puts the focus on the job being the mother's, which is why when she does work outside the home, she's viewed negatively as opposed to the father, obviously.
We had a call. DJ from Wilmington says, we don't give ourselves, and I'm assuming women, permission to be included. We are peers. We should not wait to be invited to the table. Currently, 94%, Emily Ann Aurelius of CEO Cape Fear Women in Tech, 94% of venture capital funds are owned by men. We should feel confident in our abilities and that we deserve a seat at the table.
Mm-hmm.
Talking about venture capital funds, this is another element of an initiative that Cape Fear Women in Tech is aware of at this point and working on.
Yes, with for all the entrepreneurial efforts that are happening locally, there's just been an upswelling of it through contributions of UNCW's CIE, Center for Innovation and Entrepreneurship, the work that's done at Tech Mountain to help foster a lot of these young companies here. Building a lot of these companies up is going to help our economic development locally. So what we've noticed is that there aren't as many female entrepreneurs as there are male entrepreneurs. And of the female entrepreneurs that do go out for venture capital funding, they are less likely to get it. Something around 3% are funded.
They're less likely to fund their idea.
Yes.
Why?
Well, the interesting thing is that if you look at the statistics, the companies that are headed or have females on the board of directors outperform in like a 6-year span. They outperform their other people, the other companies, by 26%. So the numbers say that it's positive to have female leadership and positive, but why isn't that being backed by venture capitalists? And a lot of it comes down to the fact that venture capitalism is a very risky area, and everybody who's in it knows that. So they have a tendency to back people that they understand. And a lot of the people that have the money are the older white males. So they will generally back the people they understand the most, which would be the younger white males. So what we need to do is, as the writer said, we need more women up at the top so that they can help fund us. And also, we all need to be aware of our own biases in our own cognitive way that we process the world, because sometimes what we do doesn't always line up with what's most beneficial for us.
Interesting observation. And Emily Ann Aurelius, you also, in speaking to our producer, talking about what it's like to be female and proposing an idea, say, at a meeting. And this goes back to a woman's sense of herself and that confidence gap that we've talked about between men and women. You threw an example out there about an idea that a woman might bring up at a meeting, maybe not getting traction right away, and then a male colleague bringing it up.
There were a lot of this was sometime last year. This topic was discussed at length on the internet in various business blogs and posts, and basically what women see happening is they'll bring up an idea, but perhaps it's their showmanship. But no one knows for sure why this happens. But then usually the idea will get passed over in the meeting, and then 10 minutes to like half an hour later, a male will say the idea, and everyone's like, "Oh, that's a brilliant idea, Bob. We definitely should do that." And then the female is like, "Wait, didn't I just say that?"
And the male colleague gets credit for the idea. No one remembers that the female.
Exactly.
And you're talking about this as if it's a common experience for women. It's not just a story you heard.
Yes, no, it's a lot of people have covered this phenomenon, and their solution to it is to almost provide an echo chamber. So if you are a female in a meeting and there's another female in a meeting who has a good idea, reiterate that idea and say, "Great idea," and then their name.
Oh, interesting.
Jean Ann Sutherland, we talked just briefly about the fact that it's a whole different scenario for women who are low income.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And you've talked about the differences in terms of what they're pursuing and the fact that guilt isn't really a part of their picture because they're just... Go ahead.
Well, let me elaborate on that. It's not to say that there's no guilt. It's interesting that it doesn't come up right away. Because there are so many different struggles and so many different ways in which they're trying to meet resources and so forth, that it's almost like they don't have the privilege. They don't speak of the privilege. Just speaking to a friend that had been in one of my focus groups, just speaking with her last night, she was talking about how it's not that there's no guilt in terms of working outside the home, because certainly they worry about their kids going to the bus stop, and that came up a lot, wanting to be there at the bus stop for neighborhood reasons and so forth. But she said, and it kind of represents what I heard, is the guilt comes from not providing, not being able to provide. So that's far different than what I heard with middle-class moms would talk about feeling guilty about things like not too much TV time and so forth. And I didn't hear that from low-income mothers.
And that's this edition of Coastline. Jean Ann Sutherland, Emily Ann Aurelius, thank you both so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coastline's technical director is Ken Campbell. Producer is Rachel Keith. Production assistant is Caitlin Hanrahan, who was also our chief engineer today. Caroline DeVries is our webmaster. If you missed part of this episode, look for it at whqr.org, get the podcast, or find it on the WHQR app. Tune in for the rebroadcast of this episode Sunday afternoon at 3. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.